people spend more time in the pursuit of basic economic goals than in pursuit of any others. 40 hours a week for most of one's adult life, plus a large percentage of one's technical and specific education, and usually a good deal of one's free time, is spent in considering matters relating to economics. Domestic, business, and government economic matters all contribute to the fact that economics dominates modern living. Noteworthy is the fact that scarcity has gradually diminished as the dominating factor of human economics. The experience of the past several hundred years has been made available to modern man. Consider the effect of the spinning jenny and its steam engine, the internal combustion engine as applied particularly to the tractor, the silicon chip, and the whole continuing technological revolution. What began perhaps with the wheel, or the capacity to make fire upon demand, has so enlarged our productive capacity that any remaining scarcity is due to some other factor, such as the failure to apply that technology, or the problems of distribution associated with the dispersal of production. Nevertheless, man's role in the economy is an extremely limited one. It is only in very limited ways that it can be said to be truly creative. Man's economic role is one of a catalyst. Certainly, growing a ton of high-quality organic potatoes is a creative thing to do. However, it depends upon the existence of suitable earth or of organic material with which to enrich it. Potato production depends upon the sun, on the presence of water and all the necessary elements, and of course, the existence of the original potato plant. Man began with an incredibly diverse and rich world in which he found matter energy in every conceivable form. An extraordinary variety of life forms existed at every level, from the microbiological through the vegetable and the various animal kingdoms to the human race. In this world, the smallest effort could produce food. For example, breadfruit plant could be taken from Tahiti to the West Indies, or a seed placed in a certain environment could make available huge food resources which otherwise would not exist. Man's search for freedom began when circumstance, effort, or some other factor released him from devoting his full attention to economic imperatives. Until an adequate food supply is ensured and sufficient clothing and shelter is available to prevent death or ill health from exposure, the total resources of man have to be devoted to these primary objectives. Of course, man does not live by bread alone. However, without sufficient bread, he does not live at all. The first requirement for increasing freedom is therefore a matter of economic achievement and liberation from basic, compelling, and undeniable needs. It might be said that man began with a very considerable basic capital, consisting of the earth, soil, oceans, precipitating rain, and solar energy, which gave the earth warmth and allowed plants to grow through photosynthesis, is thereby laying the basis for all of the higher life forms that depend upon these basic processes. Against the background of this enormous abundance, man's efforts as a catalyst to bring together the various elements that make for increased production is a very modest role. God is the largest factor in production. Even the atheist who would prefer to say that these economic assets were just there must realize that they constitute a greater part of the basic requirements of production than does the small catalytic role of man. However, modern man is the inheritor of much more than basic capital. Added to this has been the enormous cultural capital, which has been contributed by previous generations of mankind. Such simple essential devices as the lever, the wheel, the basic knowledge of how to start a fire, and knowledge of the metals contribute most of the remaining factors of production. Our economic inheritance consists of more than mere productive technology. The existence of the highly developed English language, which allows hundreds of millions of people to communicate together, is one of the purely cultural aspects of modern life. The internal combustion engine allowed humanity to call upon the services of literally thousands of man-powers in the production of their goods and services. It is said that a man is only capable of approximately 1/22 of a horsepower, and therefore it might be correctly considered that each car owner has at his disposal the equivalent of many thousands of slaves in previous cultures. Some of our cultural inheritance that relates to economics is still being understood and developed. The silicon chip is one such example of this, and it may take a great many generations indeed before the possibilities of this simple device have been even half exploited. The industrial and technological knowledge, which the Americans refer to as know-how, is the largest part of our cultural industrial capital. However, there are aspects other than technological, geographical, physiological, and agricultural, and all the other classifications of knowledge, which contribute to the economic effort of today. The existence of vast, fertile plains, cleared and readied for the plough by our ancestors, are part of our inheritance. So too are those mountains of commercial endeavor known as central business districts, the engineering projects which dam our rivers, and the power plants that so readily provide energy undreamed of just 100 years ago. It might be said that commercial industrial man at his best has harnessed all of his yesterdays to lighten all of his tomorrows. In the face of these initial observations, it becomes apparent that one of the great economic heresies of the 20th century, largely popularized by Marx, is that labor produces all wealth. Man is no doubt present in these productive endeavors as a catalyst or a maintenance administrator or a manager. However, in the face of our enormous basic capital and cultural inheritance, without which it is not conceivable that more than 1% of the Earth's population could be supported, there is a loss of perspective in overstating the modern role of labor. The truth is that labor, from the Industrial Revolution and before, has been progressively declining as a factor in production. It is only 60 or 70 years since our fathers walked behind the horse in order to have bread on the table. In the heavy industry and hard work of that period, one could not achieve even in a week what can now be done by a single man with a tractor in an hour. Compare the production today of a ton of steel, a pound of beef, or a page of printed material with the methods of last century. Current efficiency is many times greater and is improving at an astounding pace. In the light of these realities, the contribution of our humble labor shall be a minor factor in the abundance which its presence will witness. Yet modern society takes so much for granted. Ask yourself whether you could have invented the wheel had you not been acquainted through your inheritance with the concept. There are some people who presume they could, but history does not confirm this. Although the Incas of South America achieved some metal and stoneworking crafts and built and maintained irrigation systems which are quite beyond the modern Peruvian state to emulate, they failed to produce a single individual to bequeath the advantages of the wheel to succeeding generations. Any man who lightly assumes that he could do so is deceiving himself. Similarly, there are other peoples who have been isolated from contact with the mainstream of human cultural experience, where other inventions such as knowledge of fire making were absent. The Tasmanian Aborigines, being the most isolated people from the large land and population masses of the world, were also the most industrially backward. They understood the value of fire and made every effort to preserve embers. However, once a fire was extinguished, there was no knowledge of how to rekindle it. The overwhelming factor in all modern production is our heritage. Our heritage of all kinds of knowledge, of tools and buildings, plant and developments, is the great blessing and sustainer of modern man. It comes from nature and from all of those human beings who went before us, and even from our own yesterdays. One of the laws of association, which has greatly contributed to modern productivity, is known as the division of labor. To example the benefit that the division of labor has brought, we might consider the development of nail making. At some time in the past, an individual would build a small furnace, smelt steel, and draw this steel into long wires. Having done this, he would cut the wires into lengths, put a point on one end, and shape a head on the other, and then pack the nails into containers ready for sale. On a certain day, he would take them to market in order to trade them for other people's disposable goods. Through the division of labor, it was found that advantages were available in having one man attending to the furnace, giving it his undivided attention, while another man would carefully draw the wire from the molten metal and cut the wire into lengths. A third person pointed the wire, and a fourth made the heads, leaving it to others to cool, pack, and market them to the best advantage. When labor was divided among several people in this way, an interesting phenomenon was observed. Nails were produced at a much faster rate per employee than when one man performed all the functions. By associating together with a division of labor, several factors such as time and motion efficiencies, the development of specialized skills, and the lack of interruption necessitated by moving from one function to another, contributed together to allow the team to produce many more nails. The extra profit realized through this association is called the increment of association, the profit, if you like, of associating together. The increment of association is not confined to economic activities. It operates in all areas of life. In sport, more benefit is gained by practicing tennis with another person than by hitting the ball against a brick wall. One cannot play cricket at all unless it is in association with others. Socially, it is rather dull having a party on your own. Even in highly specialized cultural activities, such as the enjoyment of English literature, or chamber music, or a collection of pottery from some ancient time, people find that they benefit greatly by associating with others who have the same interest. The research of each of the associated individuals can be made available to all others, so that they are not confined strictly to their own efforts, but through sharing their efforts with others, they can gain access to the knowledge of all of the people with whom they are associating. And it will be found that the benefits to each are multiplied rather than added. Henry Ford, certainly one of the greatest industrialists of all time, made his greatest contribution with the concept of the assembly line, which exploited the advantages of the division of labor. The assembly line, which allowed a complex task to be broken down to the simplest single component parts. Soon another enormous potential was also opened for exploitation. In the beginning, Henry Ford's assembly line workers tightened each screw and wheel nut by hand with conventional hand tools. When the division of labor was accompanied by the electric screwdriver and pneumatic nut tighteners, efficiency and profit were further multiplied. Henry Ford quickly began to develop many of these basic aids, and it is said that he often did so through employing the most lazy people he could find at an extremely high salary in a situation in which they could not do other than work hard. At the end of a week or two, Henry Ford would approach them and ask if they had any ideas which would make the job easier. Apparently, it was his considered opinion that lazy people are more inventive than energetic ones because they are more motivated to consider easier and speedier procedures. Although Henry Ford's contribution has long since ceased, it is interesting to note the effect his methods have had on the human labor factor in car making. In the Australian motor manufacturing industry, it takes 7 weeks' work for one man to assemble one car. In the very latest of the Japanese assembly plants, it takes one man 1¼ days to assemble one car. The difference in productive rates is often quite incorrectly attributed to work attitudes. The truth is that in the latest Japanese plants, the greatest possible use is made of computerized robots and automated processes, while in the relatively antiquated assembly lines of the Australian industry, these devices have been little employed. The reason for the greatly differing levels of automation is not wholly due to economies of scale, as is often suggested. There is often an unconscious reticence to reach full efficiency, perhaps even a deliberate policy on the part of government or of the motor companies in order to maintain full employment. However, the Japanese policy of so equipping manufacturing plants as to grant them the highest possible efficiency has tended to transfer employment from the motor industry around the world into Japan. While resistance to the elimination of labor from motor manufacturing may be evident, where competition exists, it can only slow this inevitable process. The economic process of mankind is simply to take matter and to apply energy to it in order to change that matter into a more useful form. In truth, of course, matter and energy are simply different forms of the one entity, which might be called matter-energy. Since matter-energy is indestructible, it is also inexhaustible. However, given present limitations to technology and the limited available harnessed energy, usable resources in a static technology can diminish or be depleted. It would be neglectful to leave this segment on basic economics without addressing ourselves, at least briefly, to two concepts which in the early part of the 20th century brought forth enormous controversy and conflict. I refer to the concepts of private property and the profit motive. While with the economic decline of the Soviet Union during the latter part of the 20th century, this controversy has subsided somewhat, it is still important that it be considered. Behavioral scientists have demonstrated that the territorial imperative, or the need to possess specific real estate, is extremely powerful throughout all creation. It exists amongst even some of the lowest life forms, such as some worms and insects. Most species of birds and through the higher animals like the wolf and the stallion, which claim and mark out their territories. In some species, the male holds the territory and attracts the female into it. In others, such as the monkey-like lemurs of Madagascar, real estate is held communally by the separate gangs or troops of lemurs. At other times, animals such as the African buck, while their economy depends upon communally available grass, employ a system of real estate possession in the rut, in which the stronger can gain increased mating rights. It is not always apparent that these arrangements for the separate species depend upon economic considerations, although they have a bearing. It would seem, for instance, in some species of birds, where food is immensely abundant, that they will nevertheless not breed unless they are in possession of a piece of territory capable of feeding perhaps 10 couples instead of one. The need for this measure of territory would seem not to be related to economics, but rather to some psychological imperative. The fact that private property is a social arrangement common to almost all creation and not simply a contrivance of man would seem to indicate that it may well have a legitimacy and a biological necessity which is unlikely to be able to be denied in human association. This is not to say, of course, that nothing can or should be held communally, because obviously such life imperatives as the air we breathe can only justly be held in a communal way. In other areas, such assets as the English language are rightfully a social asset, available without restriction to everybody and depending for its integrity upon its being respected and not corrupted by the vast consensus. There are other areas in which communal possession is a possibility. Our money systems are a good example. It is only the prospect of the personal possession of money which induces individuals to exchange their goods or services for it. However, it is communally decided that one piece of paper of a certain colour and design shall have a value of $10, whilst another of different design shall have a value of $20, and so on. Money is a communal contrivance, and any profit made by the mint, or note issue department is therefore a community asset. Of course, there are other much discussed realities about private property. Not the least of these is that no matter what the reason, the increased energy forthcoming from individuals in the care, maintenance and improvement of what is theirs is evident in all communities. Another factor of importance with private property is that it provides a system whereby individuals can be held personally responsible for assets, thus enabling the law to be more readily applied and organised. However, beyond all this, one of the greatest factors enabling private property societies to outproduce and outdevelop socialist ones is no doubt the fact that it provides a mechanism for the decentralization of effective economic control. Where the production of a certain item is communally held, some improvement or desirable change in production method will depend for its application upon convincing an extremely large number of people that it is desirable. However, with decentralized decision-making, often one individual is in a position to make the effective decision, and therefore only one individual needs to be convinced, and the change is made. Obviously, when it is successful, the result speaks for itself, and the whole of that industry can adopt such productive methods. There are many deep psychological waters that can be plumbed in order to gain a better understanding and assessment of the worth of private property in human society. It has been observed in warfare that while soldiers believe an avenue of safe and orderly retreat is open to them, they fight extremely well. However, once this avenue is cut, they become observably more desperate, more irrational, and more given to panic. Under these circumstances, they fight less well. So, too, may private property offer a safe retreat. The concept that the Englishman's home was his castle and that even the king could not enter uninvited was no doubt a major factor in maintaining the relative goodwill between one Englishman and another. Each felt, in the final analysis, that he could go home and the problem could not follow him. Being in possession of such an advantageous option for security, he might also exhibit a more adventurous public spirit. I have visions of Stanley struggling through African jungles, pausing to wipe his brow and saying to himself, "After this is all over, I'm going home." The controversy and conflict, which has centered around the profit motive in the last 150 years, would have certainly amazed prior generations and may well astound future ones. If we ever observe a person taking action from which he cannot profit in any way, we immediately assume madness on his part. Indeed, we never even allow the possibility of human beings acting without motive. Whether it is a matter of discovering the motive for crime, or business activity, or decisions relative to family life, we continually go back in human affairs to motive, is that people will profit from their decisions and actions in some way. The profit motive, therefore, in a general sense, is widely acknowledged as the universal human motive, and so there is no prospect whatever of any revolt or departure from it. Of course, there are a great variety of human motives. Some are monetary, some are prompted by a desire for fame or notoriety, some are antisocial, some are altruistic, while others arise out of extended self-interest. It is as pointless to deny abuse of the profit motive as it is to try to propose an alternative. The answer is to so harness personal motive, to have it in accord with the interests of the community and of other individuals generally. This is a large undertaking. It involves large questions that the philosophical and religious leaders of all times have addressed. It involves a heightened sense of community and therefore is more readily found in societies that are at one with each other philosophically, religiously, racially, nationally, and culturally. Homogeneity, or if you like, a sense that other people are an extension of yourself, tend to make it easier for the individual to obey his highest self-interest, which is in accordance with the best interests of all people, but not, of course, necessarily with his own most immediate gain. The Japanese have a large advantage in their homogeneity. In summary, attempts to remove the profit motive from economic activity have simply removed the motive for economic activity. In this situation, the contraction of energy, responsibility, will, and effort have manifested themselves in society in terms of economic decline. The profit motive, whatever its dangers and its openness to abuse, is all that is open to us. In an earlier segment, we spent time in examining the service motive and extended self-interest. This service motive offers the best prospects of ameliorating any tendency to abuse the profit motive. Before we close, we make an important point which should be kept in mind throughout this course. We ask, what is the purpose of industry? The answer is that the purpose of industry is production, not employment. If employment is the goal of industry, this could be supplied by digging holes and filling them in again to such an extent that there would be full employment available at all times in all parts of the world. The purpose of industry is production. The purpose of production is consumption. Please note, the purpose of production is not employment either. The purpose of all economic activity and assets is production for consumption. It is also important to understand what is the cost of production. The cost of production is consumption. The cost of building a barbecue in your backyard is 58 bricks, one bag of mortar, and 3 hours of labor. Once this can be acknowledged, then some extraordinary mathematical calculations can follow. Consider the example of the individual marooned on an island of coconut trees, who had such difficulty climbing the coconut trees that the effort and energy expended in acquiring one coconut and eating it was exactly equivalent to the energy that he got from eating one coconut. Then that individual would be fully employed. In producing one coconut, he used all of the energy available from one coconut. The cost of producing a coconut was the coconut. What would be the cost of production of one coconut if, perhaps, one day he managed to get two coconuts for the energy he acquired from one? The free time he then had available may allow him to fashion a long stick with a cutting instrument on one end, so he could ever after, for the energy available from consuming one coconut, acquire two. What then is the cost of production of one coconut? The cost of one coconut is half a coconut. It is this profit, real profit, which has freed men from the interminable economic grindstone. This has allowed the economic emancipation of not just the few, as in ancient times, when a few with many slaves were able to peruse matters of cultural and scientific interest. Our real cultural heritage has allowed a large measure of independence from economic slavery to become available to almost all men and women. It has long been observed that without economic freedom, there can be no other freedom. In reducing the compulsive price of existence involved in obtaining human necessities in the area of economics through harnessing solar and other energy and applying it to production, people have progressively freed themselves from basic compulsive activity towards higher voluntary interests. It has often been observed that invention and genuine human advancement come out of leisure rather than work, in that a man who is fully employed without a break has no opportunity to experiment or hypothesize about possibilities for improving his lot. Through leisure and the use of it to progressively free men from economic compulsion, life has become more pleasant, less onerous, and more fulfilling, both materially and spiritually. From the age of scarcity in ancient times, humanity, in the pursuit of freedom from the economic imposter, has expanded leisure and applied it to increasing its economic enfranchisement and its freedom potentials. We stand at the very beginning of an explosion of freedom potentials in economics.